From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
You ask the questions, and I'm going to answer. You have asked questions in a hostile, combative, and even disrespectful tone, but...
Today, as President Clinton releases his memoir, we go back to Election Day 2000 to our Democracy Now! Interview with the president on everything but Monica, Leonard Peltier, racial profiling, the Iraqi sanctions, Ralph Nader, the Israeli-Palestinian situation, all that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court, in a 5-4 ruling, decided yesterday police can now stop suspicious-looking people on the street and demand they identify themselves as long as the identification is not self-incriminating. The Washington Post reports the ruling overturns one's right to remain silent and allows for the prosecution of anyone who refuses to identify themselves to a police officer. The Supreme Court also issued a unanimous ruling barring healthcare patients from being able to sue HMOs for damages if the managed care companies refuse to cover treatment ordered by a doctor. The ruling overturns patients' rights bills in Texas and 9 other states, is seen as enormous victory for the insurance industry. The Financial Times has obtained a report from United Nations auditors that sharply criticizes how the U.S. occupation authority in Iraq has spent more than $11 billion in Iraqi oil revenues. The report claims that the manner in which the money is funneled from the oil accounts to reconstruction projects is, quote, open to fraudulent acts. There was also little accountability as to how the money was spent. Some Iraqis have expressed concern that the CPA's books will never be audited, since after June 30th, so-called, when the CPA will cease to exist. One Iraqi political aide said, quote, I lament the lack of transparency and lack of involvement by Iraqis. The Republican controlled Senate rejected an effort by Democratic lawmakers yesterday to lift a ban on news organizations from photographing flag-covered coffins of U.S. troops killed in Iraq. The vote was 54-39. Senator John McCain of Arizona was one of two Republicans to vote for lifting the ban. In Iraq, 4 U.S. soldiers were killed after apparently being shot in the head in Ramadi. Another GI died in Baghdad. Meanwhile, in Washington, a senior U.S. intelligence official is preparing to publish a book anonymously that charges the U.S. is losing the war against al-Qaeda and that the invasion of Iraq helped Osama bin Laden. In the book, titled Imperial Hubris, the official warns bin Laden may attack the United States before the November election to help ensure the re-election of President George Bush. This news from Russia, at least 46 people died in the Russian province of Ingushetia near Chechnya after 200 gunmen carried out coordinated raids. Among the dead were the province's interior minister, 18 police officers, and over 20 civilians. The BBC reported some Russians may have also been taken hostage. Iran has announced it will prosecute 8 British Navy sailors who were detained yesterday for illegally sailing into an area controlled by Iran near the Iraqi border. Iran seized the men and 3 British naval craft. The British government said the men were training the Iraqi River Patrol Service, but no Iraqis were on board at the time. Tension was already high between the two countries. Last week, Britain helped draft a resolution criticizing Iran's nuclear program. In Saudi Arabia, Al-Qaeda has appointed a former Saudi security officer named Salah Mohammed Al-Oufi to head the organization in Saudi Arabia following the killing of Abdul Aziz Al-Mukrin on Friday. A cousin of the new Al-Qaeda leader was one of the 19 September 11th hijackers. The Israeli government has banned a journalist from the Sunday Times of London from entering Israel. The journalist, Peter Hunam, exposed the story of Israeli nuclear whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu in 1986. He's now working on a documentary about Vanunu, who revealed that Israel had a secret nuclear weapons program. Vanunu was released last month after 18 years in jail. On Monday, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan warned there's an alarming resurgence of anti-Semitism around the world and called for UN bodies to address the problem. Annan's comments came as part of the first UN-organized seminar dedicated to anti-Semitism. Annan said, quote, "When we seek justice for the Palestinians, as we must, let us firmly disavow anyone who tries to use the cause to incite hatred against Jews in Israel or elsewhere." In campaign news, 48 Nobel Prize-winning scientists issued an open letter yesterday backing Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry while charging President Bush has compromised the world's future by shortchanging scientific research. Opening arguments are scheduled to begin today in the U.S. government's case against attorney Lynn Stewart. The government has accused her of illegally passing on messages of her client, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, at a news conference. Stewart and her attorney, Michael Tiger, contend she was simply carrying out her duty as an attorney representing her client. At a hearing on Friday, Tiger said, quote, "Lawyers, particularly lawyers for those accused of terrorism, are also constitutionally mandated independent voices. The Bush, Ashcroft, Rumsfeld administration does not like independent and courageous lawyers," he said, "not in the prisons of Iraq, not at Guantanamo, not in the military brig in Charleston, and not in New York." This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting on over 220 radio and television stations around the country and on Free Speech TV Dish Network, Channel 9415. I'm Amy Goodman. As the June 30th so-called transfer of sovereignty in Iraq approaches, resistance to the U.S. occupation continues unabated. Bombings, assassinations, house raids, mass detentions, kidnappings, torture are daily occurrences in Iraq as U.S. forces and Iraqi resistance clash under occupation. As far back as July 2003, Israel warned the U.S. would not be able to bring stability or democracy to Iraq. Israel was one of the most enthusiastic supporters of the Iraq invasion. This according to investigative reporter Seymour Hirsch in this week's issue of The New Yorker magazine. Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister, reportedly warned Vice President Dick Cheney that the U.S. had lost in Iraq and said the only issue is, quote, choosing the size of your humiliation. Now Israel has hundreds of agents, including members of Mossad, operating in Kurdish areas in northern Iraq. In addition, Mossad is now conducting covert operations in Kurdish areas of Iran and Syria. According to Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker magazine, one former Israeli intelligence officer said it's real politique. By aligning with the Kurds, Israel gains eyes and ears in Iran, Iraq, and Syria. The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh joins us now on the phone. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
So can you tell us in full what you found in yet another one of your groundbreaking pieces today?
Well, simply, as you said, Israel, which did very much support the war, and I'm sure some of the people in the audience know, there's even internal investigations now going on inside Israel into whether there had been falsification of evidence on weapons of mass destruction. And some of this falsification had been given to the United States before the war, obviously. As an Israeli once told me, it's wonderful to wake up in the morning and see America in the east, you know, in Iraq to the east of Israel. And so for Israel, obviously, getting the United States into the Middle East was very important. But once we got there, we did it so badly that by last summer, there was a lot of concern. One of the concerns being we were ignoring the fact that Iranians were coming across the border and helping the resistance to organize. No Iranian was taking any offensive action against Americans. They were simply helping their allies who were against us to organize, as I said. And eventually what happened is they moved into Kurdistan. The Israelis have had longstanding ties to the Talibani and Barzani clans in Kurdistan, the two leaders of Kurdistan. And there are many Kurdish Jews that emigrated to Israel, and there's still a lot of connection. But at some time before the end of the year, and I'm not clear exactly when, certainly I would say good 6-8 months ago, Israel began to work with some, train some Kurdish commandos. Ostensibly, the idea was the Israelis, some of the Israeli elite commando units, counter-terror or terror units, depending on your point of view, began training, getting the Kurds up to speed. I think the initial goal was to help the United States fight the insurgency. We were doing very badly. Our special forces were not able to find the opposition, despite all the ballyhoo. Our Delta Force and SEALs simply weren't able to accomplish the mission that we thought they could. That is to, through interrogation and house-to-house searching, find the people that were running the opposition against us, the growing opposition. I think, of course, there was a lot of misjudgments. One of the big ones being that last fall we concluded there was a finite number, 5,000 people or so, who were involved in leading the insurgency. You remember those statistics that were given to us by Abizaid and Sanchez, the American Army commanders there. It seems clear now that was a huge mistake. There was a widespread disaffection, probably inspired as much by our actions as anything else. In any case, once there, Israel got into terrific trouble with the Turkey. Turkey is Israel's, the whole point of Israel's survival mechanism is to find non-Arabs and work with them, like Kurds. And like in the case of Turkey, they actually were had established a very good relationship with a largely Islamic country, a very progressive country, and in terms of being Islamic, not fundamentalist. And Israel, I think something like 300,000 Israelis vacation, you know, every year in Turkey. It's a great place to go, good shopping, et cetera. And Israel's jeopardizing that longstanding relationship now because the Turks have gone absolutely batty about Israeli support for Kurdistan simply because that also suggests that the Kurds will do, as they're threatening to do, go independent. And also move to seek the oil there. Therefore, the Kurdish borders are about 40 miles or so from Kirkuk, the large oil field in northern Iraq. And all of this is very dangerous and would spark certainly another great conflict up there if Kurdistan goes independent. The Turks would not tolerate that. That's not acceptable. There's huge Turkish minorities inside Kurdish minorities inside Turkey, inside Syria, inside Iraq, inside Iran. And all those countries would feel very unshaky. For example, 2 million Kurds live in Syria. They would feel very shaky by an independent Kurdistan. It's a destabilizing move by Israel, I guess, a move that they see in their good interest. And as you said, The Israelis are actually helping to are involved on the ground, I understand, inside Iran. Now, they're not inside Syria, but Israeli agents are working to collect intelligence on Iran because Israel sees Iran as its great menace, not only because of its nuclear potential nuclear weaponry. Iran, we don't know what exactly Iran is doing with nuclear weapons, but also because Iran has, as everybody agrees, if there's a winner in this mess in the former Iraq or whatever we want to call it now, it's going to be Iran. They're going to emerge as the strongest country. They have as a large population. They're going to emerge as the winner politically of the whole mess.
Can you talk more about the Iran-Syria-Turkey relationship? Close relationship.
It's always been dicey. I mean, 10 years ago, Turkey and Syria almost came to war because Turkey, as I said, had, I think from about 84 on, for 15 years, at least a dozen years anyway, there was a huge, violent Kurdish insurrection inside Turkey. More than 30,000, most of them Kurds, but Turkish citizens were killed. By the group we now call it the PKK, or it was called then the PKK, a group led by a man named Ocalan, O-C-A-L-O-N. And the Turks were just as brutal in stamping it out in the middle 90s. They snuffed it out with a horrible brutality and great abuses. Its leader, the leader of the what we now call the PKK, went to Syria and was harbored there by the Syrians. And Turkey... in the late 90s, literally their generals threatened war with Syria. And now Syria released the guerrilla leader, the insurrection leader, and the Israelis helped track him down and catch him somewhere in Africa, not Nigeria, but one of the countries in Africa. He was, I think, Kenya. And the Israelis actually captured the Turkish, or helped capture the Turkish insurrection leader, the Kurdish leader, which endeared them a little bit to Turkey. That helped improve Israel's relationship with Turkey. But boy, by the 1999-2000, Turkey and Syria were really staring daggers at each other. There's always been a natural rivalry between Turkey and Iran. They're both the same size. One is a fundamentalist country now. The other one, obviously Iran, theocracy. And here is Turkey very much committed to a very progressive form of Islamic rule. If there was a role model for the America to follow in the world, in the Middle East, it would be Turkey. Instead of trying to recreate a democracy that is impossible to obtain in Iraq anyway. So there's always been tension between Turkey and Iran and Turkey and Syria. And now, because of the Kurdish threat and because of the disaster in Iraq, and, you know, obviously everybody there is telling me, if you think we ain't seen nothing yet, wait till July 1st. And I quote somebody, actually a German intelligence official, a very senior official, is saying to me, with almost humor, I guess you could call it black humor, you're going to hand over sovereignty, is that what you call it, to the Iraqi new vice premier and prime minister, et cetera? What sovereignty? What are you handing over? There's no police. There's no army. There's no government. There's no electricity. There's no water. There's no mail. There's no telephone. What exactly are you giving to this government? You know, you don't have it to hand over, which is probably as good an assessment as you won't read in the newspapers in America that you're going to get. And so there you are. We've driven Turkey, Syria, and Iran into each other's arms. They're all cooing. We have a looming disaster on our hands in Iraq. We have a new prime minister that I write about that's very dubious at best, Mr. Alawi. And once again, I guess you could say, we do like to live in the bubble, don't we?
Cy Hirsch, what is the U.S. role in Israel's covert presence in Iraq?
Well, obviously acquiescence. I mean, at the minimum, acquiescence. We certainly know all about it and didn't lean on them. In fact, there's a high level, I think the chief of staff of the Turkish army or the Turkish armed forces. There's a very high level military delegation of Turkish officials, military officials in Washington now. They arrived over the weekend, I think. They're certainly here now, the leading generals, to talk about just this issue. What are we going to do about it? What can we do with Israel? I asked a very senior intelligence CIA official about this last week. And his comment, which I think is really pretty accurate, and he said, really, how much control do we have over Israel? I mean, they're going to do what's in their best interest no matter what we say. And this is a complicated one because people like Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle, the famous neocons, were really great champions of the Israeli-Turkish relationship. And now, as I said, the Israeli move into Kurdistan is destabilizing that. What the Israelis did that was remarkably stupid, I think, and I understand has caused enormous problems inside the Israeli government on just the issue of how dumb they are, is when the Turks began to raise questions about the growing Israeli presence in Kurdistan. And Kurdistan, Iran has got great intelligence in there, so does Turkey. It's not hard to penetrate. Kurds are you know, they're great bargainers and buyers and sellers, and one can easily buy information there. In any case, Turkey learned quite a bit earlier this year and asked the Israelis, their great buddies, about this, and Israel said officially to them that there's nothing there, and what the people that are there, Israelis are there as private citizens doing their own work. And I can tell you, I was in Ankara, and I did see, I can't quote them, but I did see many of the, it's clear from my story, very senior people in the government. And they are really angry about this. They will not tolerate an independent Kurdistan. They will simply go to war immediately. And they won't tolerate even the idea that the Kurds are getting closer and edging. In their public statements, the Kurds are saying more and more that if things go badly in Iraq, they will consider going independent. And so Israel sort of screwed the pooch with its own ally, and then they put themselves in a terrible position with a journalist like me of having to issue these stringent and strong denials, which between you and me, people in the government acknowledge are just pro forma. They stuck themselves. They said, we don't have anything there. What happened is some of the intelligence people, Mossad, and some of the military people obviously don't go into Kurdistan and run operations in Iran with Israeli passports or anything connected to Israel. So they wash them. They sheep dip them. We use the word sheep dip and dip for taking in a military person. In America, when you take in a military officer and you redress him as a civilian and send him into a war zone, that's called sheep dipping. The same thing happened with the Israeli Mossad and their intelligence military people. They went in undercover.
Well, Seymour Hersh, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. His latest piece appears in this week's edition of The New Yorker magazine.
Bye.
When we come back, bye-bye. When we come back, we bring you back 4 years as President Clinton releases his memoir to an unusual interview we had with him on Election Day 2000. Stay with us.
Aman aman, 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 dad, dad, bidad, jasadun ashbah shayin. جسد أشبه شيء بالخيال وفؤادي عن هواكم غير سالي وفؤادي عن هواكم غير سالي.
Amar Taufik here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, former President Clinton's memoirs have hit the bookstores across the country. All three editions of the 1,000-page book, the abridged, the large print, and the regular version, are in the top 10 of the online bookseller Amazon.com. The cable networks have already begun their orgy of Clinton bashing, with Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky their main thrust. A one-hour appearance appearance on Sunday on CBS's 60 Minutes kicked off the media extravaganza. In that interview, Clinton backed President Bush's invasion of Iraq, but said his timing to launch the war was wrong. The interview was promoted for days with an excerpt about Monica Lewinsky. The program was watched by more than 15 million viewers, and it went smoothly. Unlike what happened with the BBC television interview that will air tonight, President Clinton reportedly loses his temper with host David Dimbleby when he's repeatedly quizzed about his affair with Monica Lewinsky. Clinton's outrage at the line of questioning is being billed as the first time the former president's been seen publicly losing his temper in an interview. But it did happen before. 4 years ago, an interview for Democracy Now. Well, for a little background, let me read from my book, The Exception to the Rulers, which I wrote with my brother, journalist David Goodman. The chapter is called Not on Bended Knee. On Election Day 2000, I was in the Democracy Now! Office at WBAI on Wall Street when I received a call minutes before going on the air at 9 a.m. The caller said, "Hello, I'm calling from White House Communications." Things get very frantic moments before broadcasting. We get a fair number of unusual calls. White Horse? That's the famous tavern in Greenwich Village where poet Dylan Thomas was said to have drunk himself to death. Even the White Horse has a PR agent? I thought they'd said White Horse Communications. Then the caller said, "The president would like to speak to me." I said, "The president of what?" We're on the air in less than a minute. "The president of the United States," they said. "Oh, please," I said. They said, "He'd like to call into your radio program." "Yeah, right," I said. "Whatever." I ran into the studio as the theme music for Democracy Now! Was playing. Our producers were Brad Simpson, a history grad student, and Maria Carrion. Maria had produced Democracy Now! For 2 years before moving home to Spain and had flown back just to help out for the election. That was supposed to mean 3 days, but this was the election of 2000. She ended up staying for 5 weeks, from the night before the election to the day after the final selection of George W. Bush. I could hardly tell Maria and Brad, as they were frantically putting the finishing touches on the election show, that the president was calling in, especially because I didn't believe it myself. But as the music swelled, I said, "By the way, that was the White House on the phone. They said the president might call in." "Yeah, right," Maria said, and I left it at that. Well, when Democracy Now! Finished, we were about to head out for coffee when someone began shouting from master control, "President Clinton's on the phone." Maria ran in, took the call, yelled for me to get into master control immediately. Gonzalo Oberto, the host of the Latino music show that follows Democracy Now! On Tuesdays, was at the control board. I ran into the studio and heard over the blasting Latino beat the disembodied voice of President Clinton saying, "Hello, hello, is anyone there? Can you hear me?" The faders on our microphones were all the way down. The music was all the way up. I practically dove over the master control board and pulled down the music, put up all our mics, and welcomed the president to WBAI. The Washington Post later wrote of the encounter, "For Clinton, it was supposed to be 2 minutes of get out the vote happy talk with a progressive radio show and then gotta go." Well, the story continued, "In this insider media age when oh-so-serious reporters measure status by access to the powerful, Goodman's the journalist as uninvited guest," wrote Michael Powell. "You might think of the impolite question, she asks it," and it went on from there. Well, let's go directly to the interview. There was no question this was President Clinton's voice, so we just launched in.
Mr. President, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
You're calling radio stations to tell people to get out and vote. What do you say to people who feel that the two parties are bought by corporations and that they are, at this point, feel that their vote doesn't make a difference?
There's not a shred of evidence to support that. That's what I would say. It's true that both parties have wealthy supporters, but let me just give you the differences. Let's look at economic policy. First of all, if you look at the last 8 years, look where America was 8 years ago and look where it is today. We have the strongest economy in history, and for the first time in 30 years, the incomes of average people and lower-income working people have gone up 15% after inflation. The lowest minority unemployment ever recorded, the highest minority home ownership, the highest minority business ownership in history. That's our record. If you look at our proposals, what do we propose to do? We propose a tax cut that helps average people for child care, for long-term care, for paying for college tuition, for retirement savings. We propose to invest large amounts of money in education, health care, the environment, in our future. And we propose to keep paying down the debt because that keeps interest rates lower. What do the Republicans propose? A tax cut that's three times as big. Most of it goes to very wealthy people. The top 1% of the people get as much money as they would spend on health care, education, and the environment combined. They propose to privatize Social Security, and if you add the two things together, we'll be back in deficits, which means the economy will go downhill and interest rates will be higher for ordinary people.
President Clinton.
Look, that's just one example. You asked the question. There's not.
Right.
Look at campaign finance reform. The Democrats are for it. The Republican leadership kills it.
Well, let me just
look at the environment. We got the cleanest environment in history, the best environmental record in history. The Republicans want to reverse our environmental record. So give me. You can't give one example of where both parties are dominated by large corporations and therefore there's no difference. The American people's lives are a lot better than they were 8 years ago. The truth is there's an ideological struggle between those who believe that the best way to grow the economy is to give more money to the wealthy and the Democrats who believe that the wealthy will make more money if average people do better.
President Clinton, since it's rare to get you on the phone, let me ask you another question. That is, what is your position on granting Leonard Peltier, the Native American activist, executive clemency?
Well, I don't have a position I can announce yet. I believe there is a new application for him in there, and when I have time after the election's over, I'm going to review all the remaining executive clemency applications and see what the merits dictate. I will try to do what I think the right thing to do is based on the evidence. And I've never had the time actually to sit down myself and review that case. I know it's very important to a lot of people, maybe on both sides of the issue, and I think I owe it to them to give it an honest look-see. So part of my responsibilities in the last 10 weeks of office after the election will be to review the requests for pardons and executive clemencies and give them a fair hearing, and I pledge to do that.
And you will give an answer in his case?
Oh, yeah. I'll decide one way or the other.
And finally, do you support a moratorium on the death penalty, given these studies that show how racist it has been, it has been applied
in a racist
manner?
I certainly support what the governor of Illinois did, because there was clear evidence in Illinois that a lot of mistakes had been made. In the case of the federal government, I have asked the Attorney General to conduct a comprehensive review and to let me and to report back to us on the racial disparities and on any question of guilt, on adequate assistance of counsel, on all those things to determine whether there should be a moratorium. And I haven't gotten her findings yet. Now, so far, the only two cases which have come up have been deferred while we do this study, and so when that comes in, and if it comes in while I'm still in office, then I'll make a judgment, and if it doesn't, I think that the next president, I would hope, would make the same decision based on the merits, based on what the evidence shows. The disturbing thing to me is that there's not only an apparent racial disparity on death row, but also in the federal government, but also way over half the cases come from a relatively small number of the U.S. attorney's offices. Which is, it's disturbing. But again, let me just say this. If you're concerned about that, that's a good reason to vote for Al Gore and Joe Lieberman and Hillary for the Senate and for the people in New Jersey who can hear you for John Corzine, because we know the Democrats care about these issues and we know they're not very important to the Republicans.
Vice
so
President
that's another
Gore,
example of another reason you ought to vote for the Democrats.
Gore supports the death penalty.
He does, but.
And Lieberman.
Yes, they do. But there's a difference in supporting it and thinking that you would carry it out even if you thought the system was fundamentally unfair. His opponent.
But the studies
But the studies are not complete because the studies have to. What the Attorney General is doing is not just looking at everybody that's been convicted, but everybody that could have been charged that wasn't. There's a lot more stuff that needs to be done, and it may confirm the initial view of who's on the death row. But I think what you ought to look at that as compared with Texas, for example, where there was evidence that lawyers falling asleep in their trials were not enough to deter Texas from continuing to carry out the death penalty, which I thought was unacceptable. And so I think that if you're interested in having somebody that at least has the capacity to look at the fairness of this, you only have one choice.
Well, I guess many people were quite disturbed that when you first ran for president, you went back in the midst of your campaign to Arkansas and presided over the execution of a mentally impaired man.
Yeah, but let's go back to the facts here. He was not mentally impaired when he committed the crime. he became mentally impaired because he was wounded after he murdered somebody. And the law says that it's your mental state at the time you committed the crime. That's something no one ever says that when they talk about it. Had he been mentally impaired when he committed the crime, I would never have carried out the death penalty because he was not in a position to know what he was doing. That is not what the facts were. Secondly, if I had not gone home, I would have been accused of putting a tough decision off on somebody else.
President Clinton, my name is Gonzalo Aburto. I'm a Latino living here in New York. I'm the host of La Nueva Alternativa here at BAI. I want to ask you why Latinas and Latinos in the United States should vote for Gore and Lieberman.
I think they should vote for Al Gore and Joe Lieberman for several reasons. First of all, we are committed to fairness for legal immigrants, and we're trying to pass a law right now to guarantee that. And our opponents in the Republican Party are opposed to that. And the congressional leaders are opposed to it, which is another reason to vote for Al Gore, Joe Lieberman, and for Hillary, for John Corzine in New Jersey. The Latinos should know that the Democrats favor fairness for immigrants. Secondly, we favor affirmative action. Thirdly, we favor hate crimes legislation and employment non-discrimination legislation and the appointments of judges to the Supreme Court that will protect civil rights and human rights. And fourthly, let me say again, we have had an economic policy that has dramatically improved the lives of Latinos. When I became president, the Latino unemployment rate was 11.8%. Today, it is 5%, the lowest in the history of the country. So if you're looking for somebody that wants to make sure everybody is part of America's present and future, Al Gore is your man. He also proposes to put more money into the schools in the poorest parts of our country, to modernize the schools, to hire more teachers, to connect all the classrooms to the Internet. He proposes health care reforms that would provide medicine for seniors on Medicare, and more health insurance for children and for the working parents of low-income people. The Latino working families have the highest level of uninsured people of any population group in the country. So for all those reasons, Latinos should vote for Gore and Lieberman and Hillary.
Yet despite massive protests in Puerto Rico, the U.S. Navy continues to bomb, and you've the island of Vieques, and you have authorized this.
Well, now, wait a minute. Wait just a minute now. The United States Navy has an agreement with the government of Puerto Rico, the representative of all the people of Puerto Rico, to turn back the western half of Vieques to Puerto Rico, to not have any live fire bombing. There's no live fire bombing going on there. And to terminate all the training within a couple of years, during which time they have to find a new place to train. So this training that's going on now is subsequent to an agreement. Now, the Republicans in Congress broke the agreement, and instead of giving the western part of the island to Puerto Rico, gave it to the Interior Department to manage. If I can't find a way to give that island, the western part of the island, back to the people of Puerto Rico and to honor the agreement that the government of Puerto Rico itself made with the support of the local leaders, including the mayor of Vieques, then the people of Puerto Rico, I think, have a right to say the federal government broke its word and the training has to stop right now. But I think the training should stop because the people don't want it there. Mm. We need a place to train, and we're in the process of finding another place, and we made an agreement with the governor and the people of Puerto Rico and the island of Vieques for the training in the past. So I think it was a good agreement, and I think the agreement ought to be honored, and I was disappointed that the Congress didn't fully honor it, but I think I can find a way to keep the commitment of the federal government anyway, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Mr. President, what do you think about that possible amnesty for trabajadores indocumentados?
Well, I think that that's what I meant earlier. I've got a bill before Congress now that would treat legal immigrants from Honduras, from Guatemala, from Haiti, from Salvador, in the same way that the Congress has already voted to treat immigrants from Cuba and Nicaragua. I think that it's not right the way we have treated a lot of these immigrant populations differently. I know there aren't many Liberians probably among your listeners. Most of them live up in the Rhode Island, Massachusetts area, but they also were being treated unfairly, and I'm trying to get them included in immigrant fairness. And again, I'm having a big fight with the leadership of the Republican Party in Congress. So the Democrats are for that, and the Republicans aren't. So that's another reason, if you care about that, that we need to have someone to stand up to them. And that means that we need Al Gore. And if I think the Democrats have a good chance to win the House and maybe the Senate. But if we don't win, it's very important that Gore be the president, because somebody's got to be there to stop the extremist Republicans in Congress. And therefore, we need every Democratic senator we can get. We need Corzine in New Jersey. We need Hillary in New York. And we need, most important, we've got to have Gore and Lieberman in the White House.
President Clinton, UN figures show that up to 5,000 children a month die in Iraq because of the sanctions against
Iraq. That's not true. And that's not what they show. Let me just tell you something. Before the sanctions, the year before the Gulf War, you said this. How much money did Iraq earn from oil? Answer, $16 billion. How much money did Iraq earn last year from oil? How much money did they get? Cash on the barrelhead to Saddam Hussein. Answer, $19 billion. That he can use exclusively for food, for medicine, to develop his country. He's got more money now, $3 billion a year, more than he had 9 years ago. If any child is without food or medicine or a roof over his or her head in Iraq, it's because he is claiming the sanctions are doing it and sticking it to his own children. We have worked like crazy to make sure that the embargo only applies to his ability to reconstitute his weapon system and his military state. This is a guy who butchered the children of his own country, who were Kurds, who were Shiites. He used chemical weapons on his own people. And he is now lying to the world and claiming the mean old United States is killing his children. He has more money today than he did before the embargo. And if they're hungry or they're not getting medicine, it's his own fault.
The past two UN heads of the program in Iraq have quit, calling the U.S. Policy, U.S.-UN policy, genocidal. What is your response to that?
They're wrong. They think that we should reward Saddam Hussein says, I'm going to starve my kids unless you let me buy nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, and biological weapons. If you let me do everything I want to do so I can get in a position to kill and intimidate people again, then I'll stop starving my kids. And so we're supposed to assume responsibility for his misconduct. That's just not right. I know that, you know, the truth is a lot of these people want to start doing business with Saddam Hussein again because they want his money. And, they want the money he earns from oil. But it is an absolute fact that he has more money today than he did before the embargo. So if any child is without food or medicine, it's because he has made a deliberate decision to let them die, to try to build up pressure to lift the embargo so he can spend that money however he wants. He doesn't want to spend that money on his people. He wants to spend that money to become the military dictator of the Middle East again. Now, if people want to let him do it, that's one thing. But, you know, I have consistently supported changing and relaxing the embargo since I've been president to make absolutely sure that he had enough money and enough freedom in the use of the money to rebuild the country economically and to try to feed those children and get them medicine. There were a lot of problems with the embargo in the beginning. There were legitimate criticisms. But he now has more money with the absolute freedom to spend it on food and medicine and development in medical care of all kinds than he did before the embargo was put in. That's a fact. No one can dispute that. So nobody can figure out why there are problems among the children except that he won't spend the money on them. He spends the money on his own military, on his own crowd, and he avoids spending it on a lot of kids who need it so he can blame us, so he can actually get total control over his money so he can rebuild his apparatus. Remember, this is the only guy, the only world leader today who has used chemical weapons on his own citizens. And the American people, in my judgment, should give him all the money he needs to take care of his kids, but should do everything we can, and even if we're alone, to try to stop him from being in the position of murdering his kids again and murdering other children in the Middle East. That's what I believe.
President Clinton on Election Day 2000 will continue with the interview, which got rather heated, in a moment. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with our half-hour interview with President Clinton Day on Election Day 2000, in this segment begun with a question from WBAI producer Gonzalo Roberto.
Mr. President, are we going to see a substantial change in the policy through Cuba? Regarding Cuba?
Well, let me say we were on the way to that change. Back in 1996, we had a lot of changes in my first term in our policy toward Cuba. And we were working our way toward a reconciliation, and the Cubans were working their way toward more openness, more freedom for their farmers and their people. We were really making headway. And then they illegally shot down those two planes, and four people died on the planes, and the Congress passed the Cuba, the Helms-Burton bill, so-called, and I don't have much flexibility to do much more. What I have done with Cuba is to use the maximum extent of my legal powers to promote people-to-people contacts with Cuba and the Cuban people. I do believe there that the Cuban people have suffered because of the embargo, and we should do more in the area of food, in the area of medicine, in the area of people-to-people contacts. And, you know, I believe that it's just a question of time till the United States and Cuba are reconciled, and I think that the situation is tragic.
Have you just...
But it wouldn't have happened if Castro hadn't shot those planes down out of the air in blatant violation of international law. It was just murder. There's no way to put a fine point on it. I mean, and we were... I think he doesn't want the embargo lifted because it's an excuse for the problems that he has with his own administration, because he knew where we were going. He knew we were moving to reconcile. And he knew good and well that it was a total violation of international law to murder people who were in unarmed airplanes.
How do you justify imposing the embargo against Cuba and lifting it against China, normalizing relations with China?
Well, first of all, China hasn't killed any of our pilots lately. They haven't murdered any Americans. As a matter of fact, the United States accidentally and tragically killed some Chinese citizens during our military campaign in Kosovo. And we have differences with China that we think can best be resolved. That China is a nuclear power. We think they have missile capacity. We've worked very hard with them to reduce the threats of sales of missiles to renegade states, to make the world a safer place. And they've worked with us on peace on the Korean Peninsula to help the North Korean situation. And we would, as I said, I believe if Castro hadn't shot those planes down and the Congress hadn't passed a law which prohibits me from doing anything with the embargo, that we might have made some real progress there. But it's sooner or later this is going to happen, and the sooner the better. The sooner we can be reconciled with the people of Cuba, the better. But Mr. Castro is going to have to make some changes, and you can't keep just throwing people in jail for human rights violations and expect the United States to do nothing with this huge Cuban population here. I hope that we can make some more progress. And believe me, it would have happened if he hadn't shot those planes down. And sometimes I wonder if he shot them down just to make sure the embargo couldn't be lifted, because as long as he can blame the United States, then he doesn't have to answer to his own people for the failures of his economic policy. I wish it were different, and maybe it will be under the next administration.
Amnesty International has described what the Israeli forces are now doing in the occupied territories as...
Listen, I can't do a whole press conference here. It's election day, and I've got a lot of people and places to call.
Well, I guess these are the questions that are very important to our listeners, and these are the questions.
Well, I've answered them all.
Right, and we appreciate that. And
I have answered them all. Now, let me just tell you, on the Israeli-Palestinian thing, the Secretary General of the United Nations and I were together in Egypt. We agreed on a three-pronged strategy to end the violence and restore the peace talks. And with regard to the Amnesty International findings, what we agreed to do was to set up a fact-finding commission to look into what happened, how the recent violence started, and what can be done to avoid it recurring. And the agreement was that that would happen as soon as the violence was stopped. And we've had some progress in the last two or three days. Everybody's working hard. And I think the less I say right now, the better publicly, because I don't want to complicate things. I'm working my heart out to stop the violence, get the commission appointed, and get the peace process started. In the Middle East, which is something I know more than a little bit about, the only answer to this over the long run is an agreement that covers all the issues that the Palestinians feel aggrieved by, guarantees the Israelis security and acceptance within the region, and is a just and lasting peace. That's the only answer to this in the long run, and we've just got to work through it. I have some hope that in the next few days we'll be able to do it. Mr. Arafat's coming to see me on Thursday. Mr. Barak's coming to see me on Sunday, and we'll try to get it resolved. That's all I can tell you now. And I think the United Nations will support, I know they will, the implementation of the agreement we made at Sharm el-Sheikh.
Why not support a UN force in the Middle East for the illegal occupation of the territories? And at this point, I think we're around 150 people being killed in the occupied territories, overwhelmingly Palestinian.
You can support it if you want to, but the Israelis won't support it. And there was a war in which that happened. And if you want to make peace, then you have to do things that both sides can agree with. That's what a peace agreement is. And I do not believe that, just as I don't think Israel can forever impose their situation in the Middle East, and they don't either, which is why we started the Oslo peace process 7 years ago. Neither do I think that, you know, everybody else saying the UN is going to impose their will on Israel on its own territory will work out either. We've got to have a peace agreement here. That's the only way this is ever going to be resolved. And I don't think that we should do anything or say anything right now except something that will stop people from getting killed and get the peace process started again.
Many people say that Ralph Nader is at the high percentage point he is in the polls because you've been responsible for taking the Democratic Party to the right. What do you say to listeners who are listening around the area right now?
Well, I'm glad you asked that.
Concerns.
I'm glad you asked that. This is the last question I've got time for. I'll be happy to answer that. What is the measure of taking the Democratic Party to the right? That we cut the welfare rolls in half, that poverty is at a 20-year low, that child poverty has been cut by a third in our administration, that the incomes of average Americans have gone up 15% after inflation, that poverty among seniors has gone below 10% for the first time in American history, that we have the lowest African-American, the lowest Latino unemployment rate in the history of the country, that we have a 500% increase in the number of minority kids taking advanced placement tests, that the schools in this country, that the test scores among, since we've required all the schools to have basic standards, test scores among African Americans and other minorities have gone up steadily.
Can I say what
now,
some people...
Now, wait a minute. You started this, and every question you've asked has been hostile and combative. So you listen to my answer. Will you do that?
They've been critical.
Now, you just listen to me. You ask the questions, and I'm going to answer. You have asked questions in a hostile, combative, and even disrespectful tone, and you have never been able to combat the facts I have given you. Now, you listen to this. The other thing Ralph Nader says is that, you know, he's pure as a Caesar's wife on the environment. Under this administration, 43 million more Americans are breathing cleaner air. We have safer drinking water, safer food, cleaner water. We have more land set aside than any administration in history since Theodore Roosevelt. We have cleaned up three times as many toxic waste sites as the previous administrations did in 12 years. And we passed a chemical right to know law that's a very tough law. It's the best environmental record in history. Al Gore's opponent, and one of the two of them are going to be president, Al Gore's opponent has promised to weaken the clean air standards and repeal a lot of the land protections. Now, those are the facts. People can say whatever they want to. Those are the facts.
What people say is that you push through NAFTA, that we have the highest population of prisoners in the industrialized world at over 2 million, that more people are in death row in this country than anywhere else, and that people are imposed on them.
Well, all right, now, okay, that's fine, but two-thirds of the American people support that. I think there are too many people in prison, too. I have called for a total evaluation of the people in the federal prison system, a review of the federal sentencing guidelines. I did my best to persuade Congress to get rid of the discrepancy between crack and powdered cocaine in the sentencing guidelines. I agree with that. Nobody ever said America was perfect. I disagree. I think NAFTA has been good for America. I think it's been good. It has helped to reduce illegal immigration. It's helped to provide a decent standard of life in Mexico. I think it has been good. I think the agreement we made to open our markets to Africa and the poor countries in the Caribbean were good for America. People complain about our trade agreements. Trade has accounted for 30% of our economic growth, and we have the lowest unemployment rate in 30 years. How can anybody make a serious case that trade's been bad for America? We have a 15% increase in average income of ordinary Americans, the lowest unemployment rate in 30 years, and the lowest unemployment rate ever recorded among African Americans and Hispanics. Now, I don't think you can make a sane case that if we closed up our markets, that either Africa or Latin America or America would be better off.
What
about the real problem you got are the results. This country's in good shape. Now, I've talked to you a long time. It's election day. There are a lot of other people in America, and I've got to go.
Okay. One last question. What about granting an executive order ending racial profiling in this country?
I expect that we will end racial profiling. Here's the deal. The Attorney General is supposed to give me a report on that. I'm opposed to it. Al Gore is opposed to it. Here's the deal. Look, I had two people who worked for me in the White House who were wrongly stopped, handcuffed, and hassled the other day. I have spoken out against racial profiling, and Hillary has made it a big issue in New York. And so here's the issue, and here's what we're working on. We're trying to find a way to issue orders and rules and regulations that end racial profiling that clearly do not prevent law enforcement officials from investigating particular crimes. And there is a way to do it, and we're working on it, and the Attorney General is working on it. But, you know, Janet Reno was a prosecutor in Miami, in Dade County, for 12 years. She dealt with a large African-American population, a large Haitian population, a large Latino population. She had a great reputation with all of them, and she's trying to fashion a resolution of this that ends racial profiling, that clearly allows law enforcement to continue, and that's where this is now. This is going to be done, and we have to do it.
Thank you for spending the time, President Clinton.
Thank you.
President Clinton, on Election Day 2000, I interviewed him with WBAI producer Gonzalo Roberto. Well, the day after that program, I got a call from the White House press office. A staffer let me know how furious they were with me for breaking the ground rules for the interview. Ground rules, I asked. What ground rules? He called up to be interviewed. I interviewed him. He called to discuss getting out the vote, they said, and you strayed from the topic. You also kept him on much longer than the 2 to 3 minutes that we had agreed to, she said. President Clinton is the most powerful person in the world, I said. He can hang up if he wants to. Well, the Clinton administration threatened to ban me from the White House and suggested to a Newsday reporter that they might punish me for my attitude by denying me access. Not that I had any to lose. The White House spokesperson said, any good reporter understands if you violate the ground rules in an interview that it's going to be taken into account the next time you are seeking an interview. Well, first of all, we hadn't agreed to any ground rules, Clinton called us. Second, we wouldn't have agreed to any. The only ground rule for good reporting I know is that you don't trade your principles for access. We call it the access of evil. Oh, and this update. Leonard Peltier remains in jail. President Clinton didn't pardon him. Instead, Clinton granted a pardon to fugitive billionaire Mark Rich, who'd been living in Switzerland since a 1983 indictment on charges of wire fraud, racketeering, tax evasion, and trading with Iran in violation of a U.S. embargo. Rich's ex-wife, Denise Rich, was a major donor to the campaigns of both the president and his wife, New York Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. Peltier said in response, quote, we can see who was granted clemency and why. The big donors to the president's campaign were able to buy justice, something we just couldn't afford. Meanwhile, many political prisoners continue to languish unjustly, proof that this nation's talk about reconciliation is nothing but empty rhetoric, Peltier said. He remains in prison at Leavenworth. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Today's producers, Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Rich Kim are our engineers. You can go to our website and read the chapter in The Exception to the Rulers, Not on Bended Knee, with an excerpt of the interview. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.